You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, March 27th, 2018, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
Kara is tooling around the world somewhere. Where'd she say she was going to this time?
Something about Amazon.com.
The Amazon. That's right.
Oh, the Amazon.
She's in South America, right?
She's in an Amazon warehouse.
That's what I thought.
No? Damn. I must have misinterpreted.
Yeah. So I'm sure we'll get a full report from her next week. Mm-hmm. But guys, we have a huge announcement to make.
We do.
To start off the show. We are going to be at QED this year.
Oh, yeah. I cannot
In England?
Wait.
Yep.
In Manchester.
Man.
Yes, we're going to be. It's a Question, Explore, Discover. QED is a conference, a science and skeptical conference in Manchester, England. And what are the dates, Jay? Give us the particulars.
Right. The dates are tickets go on sale May 1st at 6 p.m. UK time.
And I hear it happens October 12th through the 14th of 2018.
Now, the other thing is that George is coming with us.
George Robb.
George Robb, yes.
The icing on the cake, man. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's going to be a great ride. We are trying to organize a couple of secondary events as well that we will give you more details on.
This is right after our book releases, so this will be kind of a book part of our book tour, sort of.
Nice.
And yeah. Helen Arney is the MC. She is a stand-up comedian, a musician, and a British physicist.
Wow.
Yep.
The triple threat. It's like the perfect MC for that conference.
That's right.
Yeah, right?
So I've been threatening Andy Wilson, with a incredible bear hug when I see, you know, finally meet him in person, and it's actually going to happen.
Well, don't forget to let him go, you know.
I will not.
I'll remind you.
So we have to do our live show at QED in various different British accents.
Oh, my God.
Oh, boy. I have to brush up.
Righto.
I'll go for the Brummie accent, which I don't even know how to do, but I'm going to learn it.
So. you should do Welsh, Evan.
Welsh?
Welsh is hard.
That's the hardest one.
Yep. Is it? Yep. Oh, boy. All right. Okay. I'll go for it. Why not?
What about you, Bob?
I'll do my robot voice.
Colonial
Bob?
Accent?
Don't do the robot.
No. Bob, British accent of your choice. There are many.
Think about it.
Could do a generic BBC British accent.
Welcome to the British Broadcasting Company.
Charles has been dead for 15 years.
The reviled Mary Poppins English accent.
So I've been to a QED before. Kara's been to QED.
Yeah, you have.
Before,
you're the only one.
The three of you. This is your first time.
Yeah. So how's it different?
And this is the first time that the SGU will be performing in the UK.
That's right.
That's right.
And it will be my first time in England ever.
Oh, really?
Whoa.
Yes. Yes.
So we're going to be spending more time there. We will be, as Jay said, there'll be other events in Manchester. We'll probably be visiting other cities as well. I don't want to make any promises because we haven't nailed down our schedule yet. But I'm pretty sure we'll be in London at some point during the trip. So we'll have once we completely schedule our trip, we will let you guys know when we're going to be where, or where we're going to be when. And, what we're going to be doing. But it's going to be a lot of fun. These trips
are always
awesome.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
I can't wait.
All right, Bob, you're going to start us off with a forgotten superhero of science.
Yes, for this week's Forgotten Superhero of Science, I am covering Emily Rosa, born 1987. She is the youngest person to have research published in a medical journal. And this was the Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA, no less. Incredibly impressive. So yes, at 9 years old, Rosa created and carried out an experiment that disproved therapeutic touch. At that age, I was watching cartoons and carrying my toy robots. And you know, I think I'm still doing that today. So therapeutic touch, if you don't remember, posits that human energy fields can be felt and manipulated by the hands of the special practitioners, which they can then manipulate to heal the person. So her study used 21 self-identified healers, therapeutic touch healers with varying levels of experience from just a year or two to seven or more. They each put their hands through an opaque partition, and Emily would then put her hand above one of the subject's hands and ask them which hand was her hand above, right or left. So very simple. After 280 trials, they achieved a 44% success rate, worse than guessing randomly. So this was just a beautiful, simple, but devastatingly powerful test against what was a leading treatment in alternative medicine at that time. And Rosa was recognized by the Guinness Book of Records as the youngest person to have research published in a scientific or medical journal. She did my favorite was when she did the keynote address at the 1998 Ig Nobel ceremonies at Harvard. And she just won a bunch of awards, and she did so many TV appearances I lost count. And she was amazingly poised for such a young, budding scientist. Today, Emily Rosa is a psychologist. So remember Emily Rosa. Mention her to your friends, perhaps when discussing Cochrane systematic reviews, a subtle body, or perhaps bioenergetics.
Yeah, that really was a landmark study. It wasn't just that, you know, the novelty of the lead author being so young. It was elegant, you know, the design, because it does what pseudoscientists rarely do, which is study the basic premise in such a way that it could potentially disprove it, right? So the basic premise of therapeutic touch is that there are human energy fields. Why don't we start there? Why don't we, you know, before you get into complicated efficacy trials, which are really hard to nail down, let's establish some of the basics here. Is there a human energy field? And she very elegantly proved that probably not. You know, at least practitioners can't sense a human energy field, can't demonstrate that they can detect it. And so that completely pulled the carpet out from under therapeutic touch. And what happened was that what she didn't kill energy medicine, but that study killed the term therapeutic touch. I don't know if you know, but after that,
right,
you know, they tried to salvage their reputation and discredit the study and this and that, but it didn't work. It was done. It was the study was too simple, too credible, and then so they just rebranded themselves. You know, now they shifted a lot over to Reiki, which is basically the same thing, but is, you know, like basically it's Japanese therapeutic touch.
Yeah. It's just like cutting the head off a hydra. You know, sometimes you get two more or another one just popping up, but you know, you still got to cut those heads off as well as you can.
Yeah. You still have to do it. All right. Thanks, Bob. Jay, start us off with the news items with an update on the vitamin C myth.
Yes, it's a big one. So there are countless people out there who believe that vitamin C can help you fight off a cold.
I've heard that.
Of course. I mean, I think most people have. I'd be curious to talk to my nieces who are in the, you know, late teens, early 20 age range, just to see if it kind of seeped into them as well. I bet you it did. But, you know, people believe that taking mega doses of vitamin C or drinking a ton of orange juice, you know, this is a typical recommendation that you'll hear people say in the office when you're sick. So why do people believe this, even though the research is stacked up saying that vitamin C does not have an effect or a very strong effect on the intensity or duration of the common cold? And who would benefit from spreading such false information? Pharmaceutical companies, maybe, huh? Actually, no, not this time. So it turns out that a scientist named Linus Pauling was the source of this misinformation, but there was a pretty interesting backstory to the whole thing. So first, how extensive is the misinformation? So it's mixed in with general use of vitamin supplements. So as an example, half of the U.S. population takes vitamin supplements regularly. And many nutritionists say that taking vitamins typically don't hurt, but they typically don't help either. So the story of vitamin C goes back to the 1500s in the days when people would be on long ocean voyages and they'd get scurvy. And it's not just a pirate saying, "You scurvy dog," you know, like that type of thing. Scurvy is when you have a vitamin C deficiency, and it's pretty freaking nasty. So you could have swollen hands and feet and horrible, painful, inflamed gums. Scurvy can kill you. You know, the problem was that when they were stocking the ships up with food, if they did pack citrus on there with, you know, fruits and vegetables, these types of foods don't last long, right? They don't last months on the ship. So they'd run out of it and they would then, you know, end up eating things that were salted and whatnot. And when you run out of your vitamin C source, it only takes a few weeks to develop a vitamin C deficiency, and then you could start showing signs of scurvy. So it's estimated that 2 million sailors died between the 1500s and 1800s from scurvy. So in 1747, a scientist named James Lind tried to figure out how to treat scurvy. And he discovered, after testing tons of things, that the only thing that would help is if his subjects ate oranges and lemons, right? So you take almost 200 years before scientists would find what specifically was in those fruits that was curing scurvy. Now, a scientist named Albert Zent-Guiry, 1928, identified a substance found in the adrenal gland and named it hexuronic acid. And 3 years later, in 31, J.L. Sverbly and Charles Glenn King, two American biochemists, found the crystalline vitamin C from lemon juice had the same properties as hexuronic acid. So this discovery inspired Linus Pauling, who's the scientist I mentioned earlier, to do more research. And Pauling is an actual Nobel laureate. He won two times. And in those two times that he won, he was the only one winning the award for the classes that he won in, which is, I think, nice. still to this day, he might be the only one. In 1960, wow. Pauling first got the idea of taking megadoses of vitamin C to improve health and longevity by a man named Irwin Stone. Irwin was attending a lecture that Pauling was giving, and Pauling said something along the lines of, you know, I wish I was going to live long enough to see more of the research come to fruition. And Irwin yells out, you know, you should take, you know, mega doses of vitamin C. And unfortunately, Pauling ended up using his own anecdotal evidence to fuel his belief that vitamin C was a miracle cure-all. He was saying, oh, I haven't gotten a cold in years now, and, you know, I'm feeling better, and I'm, you know, full of vitality. Pauling continued to increase the dose. I think he started around 3,000 milligrams. He cranked that up to 18,000 milligrams per day. And, you know, at this point, he had become utterly obsessed with his vitamin C research. And eventually in 1970, Pauling published a book titled Vitamin C and the Common Cold. He recommended people take 3,000 milligrams of vitamin C every day. And by 1971, it only took a year, vitamin C sales increased by an order of magnitude. And that's when it really started to slip into common culture. People began to take larger doses of vitamin C as well. You know, they were claiming that vitamin C would wipe out the common cold, make it something of the past. This is Pauling. He also started claiming that supplementing your diet with vitamins could cure pretty much anything. And during an interview in 1990, and this was 4 years before he died, Pauling said that people who take the optimal amounts of vitamin C and other supplements would live 25 to 35 years longer and be free of disease. So there was a Cochrane review of about 30 studies that showed that taking a normal daily dose of vitamin C could potentially reduce the length of your cold by up to 8%. So as an example, if you had a cold for 5 days, this could whack it back by 10 hours. But even still, the vast majority of the research just, of course, you know, none of the disease-curing aspects of it amount to anything, and its effect on the common cold has been found to be zero or negligible. So the National Institute of Health recommends that people should not take more than 2,000 milligrams or the equivalent of, the emergency. You ever guys hear of emergency packets? You put them in a bottle of water, and it flavors the water a little bit, and it's a mega dose of vitamin C.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah, don't take more than 2,000 milligrams. What they're finding is people that exceed that could get diarrhea and cramps and nausea. And then, you know, in some people, they develop kidney stones.
Mm-hmm. Oh, geez. Yeah. Nice.
Yeah, I've run across this when I used to train at my martial arts studio for a little while. They were selling these supplements. And among the supplements, I read the ingredients. And there were these incredible amounts of, among other things, vitamin C in there. And, you know, just really bad amounts in which you look up online what happens when you start taking doses like this. And that's exactly what happens. Kidney stones, kidney problems, among other things going on. So, you know, I certainly let my instructor know about that. And it wasn't long before he got rid of the stuff. Thank goodness.
Nice.
Yes. Some scientists are saying that there hasn't been a massive lashback because vitamin C is, you know, ultimately, it's just not that harmful. So, you know, it's not really, really hurting anyone. It's, you know, I would tend to disagree because overall the vitamin supplement industry is in the, you know, 20 plus billions of dollars a year. It's a massive waste of money. You know, with vitamin supplements, you're just making yourself have expensive and worthless urine, which is, you know, just a waste. It's ridiculous. You know, you should be getting your nutrition from the food that you eat. If you eat a balanced diet, you know, you're going to be fine. You know, again, like we keep saying, eat dark green leafy vegetables, you know, broccoli, things like that. You're going to get...
Unless you have a condition in which you're vitamin deficient.
Yeah, of course. I mean, there's, of course, people get... People, you know, doctors will give people, as an example, a prescription for vitamin D if they have low vitamin D or iron supplement. You know, that's different because your doctor is
right.
Specifically
yeah,
saying
that's evidence based targeted supplementation based upon lab values. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, or but just, known conditions like pregnant women trying to get pregnant should be taking folic acid. Yeah,
yep. but just
routine
go,
supplementation. There's no evidence for it.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't need to go and spend the hundreds
hard
of dollars.
It's really hard to measure the harm because direct harm is the easiest to measure, and even that is not totally clear. There's definitely a lot of evidence that taking a lot of multivitamins or high doses of vitamins correlates with worse outcomes. It's just hard to know what the cause and effect is. Probably high doses of antioxidant vitamins correlate with increased risk of heart disease. And you know, it could just be that people who are taking vitamin supplements, there's an effect where it's the false sense of security effect where they think, oh, I don't have to worry about my diet because I take a vitamin.
Yeah.
So their diet isn't as good, mm-hmm. for example. And then, you know, again, I've had patients, this is anecdotal, but it just shows you the possibility, like patients who couldn't afford to take their prescription medication, but they're spending $200 a month on supplements. So there's a lost opportunity there. There's a lost opportunity. Oof. You know, they're spending the money on something
cost.
That they think is going to be helping them when it doesn't. And then, you know, the entire industry, this is true of the entire alternative medicine industry, promotes bizarre and false unscientific ideas about health and disease and fosters distrust of mainstream medicine. And how
sure.
do you measure the harm of that? And there's a huge correlation, you know, between taking, you know, taking high doses of vitamin C, thinking it's going to, you know, help make you live forever or whatever, and being susceptible to all the other kind of, you know, crap out there, not, you know, being anti-vaccine or whatever. So it's all a package. You know
yep.
what I mean? It's all part of this culture of anti-science and medicine or pseudoscience and medicine. You can't isolate it and go, oh, well, people aren't being directly harmed by the doses of vitamin C that most of them are taking. Okay. That's not really the concern. You know, the concern is this culture of pseudoscience and medicine. And vitamin C is kind of special because it had a massive boost by Linus Pauling, you know, a Nobel laureate scientist, genuinely brilliant basic science researcher, but no clinical chops apparently, and became a total crank. You know, he's the poster child for that disconnect between, you know, somebody who in part of their career was a brilliant scientist and then another part they were a total crank. The two
and
things
the
can exist in the
bad.
They can coexist in the same person. It's really amazing.
Yeah, I think the shortcoming there, and it's pretty common, is that the scientists may think, you know, because they're an expert in one field, you know, they're overconfident in other fields.
Yeah, or they just stop listening to other people, you know, and stop admitting their errors and their mistakes or being humble. And so their ideas just become – I think it's a natural tendency for ideas just to drift off into fantasy land unless you're anchored to reality. And if you lose that anchor to reality because you're too full of yourself to think that you need it, then you become a crank. We joke about the Nobel laureate syndrome, you know, where there seems to be a lot of scientists who were Nobel Prize winners or just really accomplished award-winning scientists, and in their later years become complete cranks. And I think it has to do mainly with they just got too big for their britches, man. They just thought, you know, hey, I'm a world-class scientist. I don't need to be anchored to reality anymore. I could just shoot from the hip or whatever. Nobody has the guts to challenge them. You know, they're surrounded by yes men. Whatever it is, they just whatever process would keep them honest is no longer functioning, and so they promote and develop these really bizarre scientific ideas.
It's interesting how they don't learn sort of the tenets of what makes for good science versus not good science, that they can't stop themselves from falling into those kinds of traps?
That's an interesting question, and it has to do with how deep does their philosophical understanding of science go. And honestly, you could be a successful scientist without being a philosopher, in that you could be technically good in your field. You could be obviously very knowledgeable, and you could have certain attributes like being creative, being able to think outside the box, right? Think of new ways of explaining phenomenon. Think, you know, being good at designing hypotheses and research to test those hypotheses and knowing how to move the ball forward, you know, in your research, and yet not really understand the critical thinking element of science, you know? And those are the people who are, they're technically good scientists, and they may be brilliant at what they do, but they just don't fully grasp the mechanisms of self-deception that we need science to protect us from. And so they fall into those traps because they didn't really, really fully understand them. And we see the whole spectrum. I think, you know, most scientists have a pretty good understanding of process, but a lot don't, you know, or their understanding is ultimately superficial, which is why so many scientists fall prey to things like p-hacking. You know, p-hacking, I think, is mostly a phenomenon of scientists who don't understand the critical thinking aspects of science. So they do things, and without understanding that, that completely invalidates their research, you know? So that's just, we just need more, I think, more thorough and universal education in the sciences in critical thinking and self-deception.
Yeah, we've said it before. I mean, there should be courses that are in the canon that teach critical thinking. I mean, it should be starting at the earliest age possible and have it go all the way through, as far as I'm concerned, through university.
So talking about pseudoscience, actually, and there's going to be a couple of segments on pseudoscience in this episode. Have you guys heard of the Atacama mummy?
The mummy?
Yes. Yes. Freaky little dude.
Yeah, this is a 6-inch mummified, almost certainly a fetus, but very malformed. It has a very a conical skull. And the bones are look more developed than what you would expect for a fetus. So it looks like, you know, it looks like something that's really, really bizarre. And of course, because of that, you could interpret it in line with it. Whatever your cultural mythology is, you could impose it upon this. So in an earlier era, this probably would, could, you know, could have been misinterpreted as a fairy, right? A small humanoid. But now, of course, it's some kind of alien, an alien-human hybrid or whatever, especially since it's got like the big head. Yeah, it's a hybrid. The person who I think was most famous for promoting that interpretation of this mummy was Stephen Greer in the documentary film Sirius. This is all about like the big government conspiracy to hide UFOs.
Oh, yeah.
And they do the typical mystery mongering where they say, wow, look at this weird thing. Nobody knows what it is, you know.
Therefore,
they spend a lot of time saying how it can't be a hoax, right? This has to be a real organism, right? A real creature. It wasn't, right? So it wasn't crafted or fabricated. It's like, okay, that's kind of a little bit of a straw man, right? Because no one's really saying that, and often that's a very common method in terms of the argument from ignorance that ufologists frequently use. Like they might say, look at that light in the sky. Well, we know it isn't X or Y. Okay. And they're just focusing on two and of the easiest things to like, it's like the token things to debunk. Say, therefore, well, we know it's not an airplane. Therefore, it's a UFO, it's a flying saucer. You know,
I read a story just like that today. Yeah. Exactly like that.
So that's their modus operandi. That's what they do.
I saw a comic recently. There's a guy, two people looking up at the sky. Guys, look, a bird, a plane. It's a plane. And that was it.
That's great. Mystery solved.
Right. So that's the argument from ignorance, you know, which we're very familiar with, very common in pseudoscience. Whereas you have to be, you know, more thoroughly consider other alternative explanations, and you would only resort to introducing an entirely new hypothesis, you know, like alien visitation, when you've exhausted all the more mundane explanations. That's Occam's razor. So, of course, you know, this is the typical scenario with UFO true believers, that they use anomaly hunting, argument from ignorance, and a completely savage Occam's razor. And then they take the short path to arrive at, therefore, this is an alien phenomenon. But of course, eventually, for many of these, especially if there's physical evidence, you know, it's hard. Like if somebody just has a story to tell, oh, I was abducted. Okay. You know, any evidence? Nope. Just got to take my word for it. Or, you know, that's nothing to do. There's nothing to investigate there. Except well, for I internal mean, you, consistency. Right.
Right so and, you got, yeah, yeah. Other explanations for conclusions that are drawn. And well, yeah, but there's it's le- much less to work
But yeah,
with.
But there's never going to be any come to Jesus moment, though, right, where you could say, aha, like here's the actual evidence and we can now say conclusively X, Y, or Z. It's just going to be one interpretation over another
This happened at night and you felt paralyzed, so the odds are overwhelming that it was some sort of hypnagogic or hypnopompic, you know, hallucination, and you can do that kind of stuff with a story.
Yeah, right. But again, we're applying critical thinking principles to the interpretation of the story.
Right.
It's not the same as
worthwhile.
We did DNA testing on the mummy, and the DNA testing showed that it was completely human.
Yep.
Right?
Awesome.
That's more definitive than it was probably hypnagogia.
Absolutely.
And that's, of course, what happened. And more recently, they analyzed the DNA from the mummy, and they found that it had a large number of mutations in genes that are involved in bone proteins. So that is exactly what you would expect to find if this were not only a human but a profoundly diseased human, and that certainly right. is consistent with its abnormally formed bones, right?
Sure. Yeah, now a critical thing there was that it was only 40 years old, which means the DNA was somewhat intact, so that was kind of critical because they were speculating that it was far older, which and if it was, then you probably might not have found any DNA to examine. The thing that was really odd for me though, Steve, is how symmetrical it was. I mean, you know, when it's asymmetrical, you would, you know, kind of like the elephant man, you know, if you saw his bones, they would clearly be asymmetrical. You think disease, but with something so symmetrical, you think, oh, that's the plan. That's how it's supposed to look, you know? And you don't think fetus.
There are disease malformations that result in symmetrical deformities. That's not. Unusual.
Yeah, but I'm just talking about a layperson looking at it. You know, you look at that little thing, you don't think disease at all. You see that to me, well, first off, I thought it was fake. I thought it was created.
That's what I thought.
I was surprised that this was actually a real, you know, biological, first of all, and then human. And
it was a human, yeah.
But still, it did not. I mean, and it had a lot of the classic alien kind of features with the elongated, you know, with the head shape and stuff.
Yeah, but it doesn't really have the dome head of the gray alien. It just has an elongated
skull. No, but
skull.
It definitely – it had – alien-esque, I would say.
Yeah,
I
it totally guess. Had some alien-like
Star Child-ish kind of.
Yeah, what the culture says, sure.
Yeah, but superficially is my point.
Yeah.
And yes. So it was probably a premature stillborn. And in the desert, spontaneously mummified. Because it's extremely dry. Yeah. I'm not sure exactly how old it is, but yeah, they estimate several decades based upon the preservation of the DNA. So that pretty much puts the final nail in that coffin. And that was the scientific hypothesis. This is a diseased person, you know. Once they imaged it enough to know that it wasn't crafted, you know, there were organs and stuff inside enough to say that, okay, this is probably a real fetus. Then say,
incredibly detailed.
I would say impossibly detailed.
Was Stephen Greer available for comment?
So It's still, you know, just the mystery mongering about it is still in this movie serious. Mm-hmm. But that's the thing. So this one case is not that remarkable, but these kinds of cases are what, you know, UFO lore is built out of. And I think I mentioned on the show before, like a number of years ago, I read a book by Carl Sagan about UFOs. And I didn't realize when I purchased it until I started reading it that the book was actually from the 1960s. And I was reading it in the late 1990s. So it was a 30-year-old book at the time I was reading it. So all of the basic principles about, you know, the UFO movement and why it's not scientific were the same, but the cases were all different than the ones that I was familiar with from the 90s. So it's like there's this just rotation of new proposed UFO cases or evidence that survives for a time until they're eventually disproved or debunked, and then they're replaced by other ones.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But
yep.
But the UFO enthusiasts don't really have a memory for the arc, you know, of the evidence. It's just the evidence that's in front of them at the time. They're mystery mongering the current cases that are preliminary, that haven't been investigated enough, or they're just permanently ambiguous and are never going to be resolved. But they're not building cases that are established or that survive close to scrutiny. You know what I mean? So you have to look at how the evidence evolves over time. And the fact that there's just this rotation of evidence that in that temporary mystery phase before it gets fully examined, that's a feature of pseudoscience, right? It's like ESP. It's the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're replacing old crap with new crap.
Yeah, exactly. So old crap gets replaced with new crap, and then that's the argument from ignorance, you know, while we're still ignorant. And then when that gets explained or showed to be a hoax, like, remember, you guys remember, of course, the alien autopsy, right? That had 5 or 6 years in the sun it was revealed to be a complete hoax. There's always something like that going on. And then the Atacama mummy, that was, you know, this had a good 10-year run or whatever, until now the DNA testing completely debunked it. And the Star Child
was around for a while.
Project was around for a while until DNA showed that was human too.
See a pattern?
Yeah, right. Or Bigfoot, same thing. You know, there's always evidence that's being purported as this is the interesting evidence until it gets shown to be crap, and then there's new stuff taking its place.
The proponents are not swayed by past.
No. They don't pay attention. They don't care.
History doesn't matter.
That's the mystery mongering.
It doesn't come into their calculations.
They are interested in the mystery, not the full process of science. So scientists reserve their judgment until definitive tests are done, and then they abide by the evidence, and they try to look at the big picture, of the hypothesis, and how is it useful? Is it predictive? Is evidence accumulating over time? They realize that science, it's not about one piece of evidence. It's about how you build a theory and how useful it is over time. The UFO hypothesis is worthless. The ESP hypothesis is worthless. You know, they don't predict anything. It doesn't lead anywhere. It's just, they're just chasing their tails. That's all it is. And the longer you pay attention to it, the more obvious that becomes. And it's also interesting to note that other than people who are making a lot of money, you know, at this, but people who are genuinely interested in these phenomena also, they tend to come and go too. You know, I think because there have been a lot of UFO enthusiasts who thought, all right, I'm going to be the guy who's going to really nail this down and prove that aliens are visiting the Earth. 5-10 years later, they realize, oh God, it's all shit. I have nothing to show for it. And then they go on with their lives. You know, they leave. You know, so we're selecting for the people who are perpetually gullible or who have figured out how to make money off of it. You know,
right.
It's too bad because those people can really do a service to other people saying, hey, I was in this field for 20, 25 years. I did research. And guess what? Despite my wants or desires, I came up with no evidence. And that in itself is a story.
Yeah.
And a good narrative for other people to learn about how you build a case for things or build a case against something if that's where the evidence turns out.
There's some of that out there, but yeah, it gets drowned out. All right, Evan, we're going to move to another bit of pseudoscience.
Right.
This is one of our Death by Pseudoscience series.
Mm-hmm.
What pseudoscience is the perpetrator this week?
Well, I must say that it seems that a lot of news outlets were buzzing about this news story from a few days ago. The internet was cross-pollinated with articles all over the place about it, where two Spanish allergy and immunology specialists published a case report involving a 55-year-old woman who died from a severe allergic reaction after undergoing live bee acupuncture.
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy.
Live bee acupuncture. Yep. The report was published in the Journal of Investigational Allergology and Clinical Immunology. Here are some of the highlights from the actual report. Apitherapy is the use of substances from honeybees, such as honey or royal jelly or even venom, to relieve various medical conditions. One type of apitherapy is live bee acupuncture, which involves applying the stinging bee directly to the relevant sites according to the specific disease. Yep, that's acupuncture. This practice is often performed in private healthcare centers or by non-medical practitioners. In other words, not real scientists or doctors. In sensitized persons, venom compounds can act as allergens, causing the release of mast cell mediators and a spectrum of allergic reactions that can range from mild local swelling to severe symptomatic reactions, anaphylactic shock, or even death. Yep. Repeated exposure to the allergen was found to carry a greater risk of severe allergic reactions than in general population. We report the case of a 55-year-old woman who had been attending apitherapy sessions every 4 weeks for 2 years with good tolerance. She decided to receive apitherapy to improve muscular contractures and stress. During an apitherapy session, she developed wheezing, dyspnea, and sudden loss of consciousness immediately after a live bee sting. Yep, she slipped into a coma and the patient died some weeks later of multi-organ failure. Yikes. Persistent hypertension during severe anaphylaxis had caused a massive watershed stroke and permanent coma with multi-organ impairment. Conclusion, the risk of undergoing apitherapy may exceed the presumed benefits, leading us to conclude that this practice is both unsafe and unadvisable. Yes, and that is something that, Steve, I know you've been writing about for, a better part of a decade, if not longer. And I know we've been talking about it even longer than that, Skeptics on the Skeptics Guide and elsewhere. And you know what? When I did a Google search into bee venom therapy, okay? And this is even with Google kind of knowing who I am. You know, they have a sense of who I am and what my science searches have been, skeptical searches, all the personal data kind of that go into my search results. Here's the first thing that came up. Lawrence Cohen, a doctor in Danbury, Connecticut, treats people in terrible pain with the venom of ordinary honeybees. Although bee venom therapy is largely unproven, about 50 U.S. physicians report good results using the substance to treat not only pain, but arthritic conditions, multiple sclerosis, and other health woes. So basically, they led me right to number one search to a place that promotes bee venom therapy. So much for my skeptical profile having any effect on my Google search. And then you couple it in with the aspect of acupuncture in which you're doing this targeted application of the venom in these meridian points, and you get sort of the best of two pseudosciences coming together to form what sounds like a real great old and proven technique. They've been using it for thousands of years with excellent results, blah, 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 the usual sorts of tropes that go hand in hand with these things. But to tell you the truth, studies have been done on this, and not only has it not shown to be effective, there are studies that show that it's darn right harmful and can, like they said, result in death. A 2015 study published in PLOS ONE found that compared with normal saline injection, bee venom acupuncture showed a 261% increased relative risk for the occurrence of adverse effects. Mm-hmm. So it's one thing to get stuck with needles in a traditional sort of acupuncture setting. But go ahead and add bee venom into that mixture. Risks go up 261%.
I mean, why even do it? It doesn't do anything. I mean, just avoid it like the plague.
It's just snake oil. So, I mean, as we said many times on the show before, acupuncture is pseudoscience. It doesn't work. There's no such thing as meridians or acupuncture points. They just simply don't exist. Talk about chasing your tail. After thousands of studies, researchers have not been able to build a case that acupuncture works for anything. It's just constantly low-grade evidence. And they've largely given up on the really high-quality studies because they don't give the results they want. So they're just doing these low-grade studies, which seem designed just to get a press release with a headline about how acupuncture works. But when you look at the study, you're like, nah, it's just one more crappy, worthless study. And then apitherapy, it's the same thing. One of the first things I wrote about as a skeptic, now we're going back more than 20 years, like 22, 23 years ago. Mm-hmm. You would think 20 years later, you know, in the real world of medicine, 20 years is about how long it takes, you know, to either prove or disprove something from scratch, you know. But here we are 20 years later and there's zero difference. There's still no evidence. There's still just a few crappy studies. You know what I mean? They haven't developed the science of apitherapy, of bee venom therapy at all. It has not been shown to work for anything. So why is that? Well, it's because it's not scientific. It's a pseudoscience. And in medicine, they want to chase their tail because they want to be stuck in that mystery phase because that's when they make all their money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They really have no incentive to do actual science because it's a lose-lose. The only thing that really could happen is that it's being shown not to work. I mean, I'm sure that there's true believers out there, but I think at some level, like, they know they're really worried about doing the kind of studies that could potentially show that it doesn't work, because that's a risk that they don't want to take and they don't have to take it. So why should they, when they could just do no studies and just be stuck in that perpetual phase of, oh, some people think it works, or they like saying that it's being studied, right? But they want those studies to be worthless, right? Because then what they're after is the act of being studied, not the result of being studied, not the result of the research itself.
Right.
Does that make
yep.
sense?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. They're taking what they can. Yep.
They want to be able to say, oh, yeah, scientists are looking into this. And then when negative studies come out, doesn't change what they do. They're like, I don't like that study. I like the study over here. Yeah. That's, you know, crappy, but it gives the results that I want.
Or my patients never have these problems. They all walk away very happy.
Well, all I know is it works for me.
that's right. No, and there are plenty of testimonials online from the people, from these practitioners.
Yeah.
And they literally say it. They say no side effects. Always positive results, and they're treating all sorts of things, including cancer.
Yeah,
which is, you know, pretty low. So
all the red flags. Good for what
ails you. All the red flags.
No side effects. Always works 100% guaranteed. There's not a guarantee.
Yeah, exactly right. Except, you know, in the case of, I mean, you have to know by now.
If it doesn't work, well, you must have been doing something wrong.
Yeah, right. But exposing yourself to a bee sting. I mean, even I knew as a kid that bee stings can be fatal, and people can go into shock. So what?
The practitioner didn't have an EpiPen in the office, and that's the other thing you have to realize is that when you go to these fringe practitioners, it's that they don't know what the hell they're doing. You know, it's like, you ever see a picture of somebody doing acupuncture? They almost never have gloves on. They don't use sterile technique because they're quacks. You know, they're giving you apitherapy and they don't have an injector there, and because they're quacks. Or whatever. So, I mean, you don't really want to trust yourself. If something does go wrong, you're in the hands of a charlatan. So you're not where you want to be.
Yeah, like it kind of reminds me of a video I saw. This guy was, I think he was doing breast implants.
Mm-hmm.
And he was using a spatula as an operating tool. You know,
kitchen spatula.
Yeah, yeah. And he's, you know, just effectively saying, I'm a surgeon and, you know, someone, you know, went for it because I guess the price was very low, and they had footage of him using a spatula in the surgery in the room that he set up to be, you know, like a surgical theater.
It's like using a shop vac for liposuction.
Yeah. Yeah, that's basically
that work?
That's what Steve is saying, though. I mean, that's the mentality. You know, that person, you know, if they don't have an EpiPen, they don't know why they should have an EpiPen.
I mean, you know, listen. MDs do horrible things at times too. Quality control is a serious issue in medicine. So, and that's in the best of scenarios. You know, it's hard to maintain consistent high levels of quality and professionalism. But when you are in the alternative, you know, medicine world where it's the Wild West, they're shooting from the hip. They're not following a rigorous process of science. Those standards are lower, and that should not come as a shock to anyone. And it really does matter. That eventually bites you in the ass.
Or stings you.
Right, or stings you in this case. All right, Bob, let's go on to some actual science. Tell us what's new with Jupiter.
Okay, so I don't know if you guys have been reading up on Jupiter lately, but Jupiter is not what it used to be. Our biggest planet has gone through a transformation of sorts, thanks in no small part to a little probe called Juno. So Juno. Yeah, these findings were recently published in four papers in the famous journal Nature. And these are just basically some of the newest things we've learned about Jupiter because of Juno. And I was just reading up on it in the past week or so and just being amazed at the images and what we've discovered and what we've learned. So I thought I'd relate some of it to you guys. So all this new Jupiter science started with, the NASA space probe Juno, which entered a polar orbit of Jupiter on July 5th, 2016. So it's been there for a little while. It's only one third of the way through its primary mission, but it's already in many ways revolutionizing our understanding of our biggest gassy planet. You guys, you really need to see some of these images online. They are amazingly detailed. The complex chaotic flows are like little works of art. They're just mind-numbing. It's just like, oh my God, the detail. We have nothing on Earth or even planned to be in orbit that can get details like that. So for now, we need to be close to Jupiter to see images like this. And Jupiter and Juno is really close to Juno. So as you can imagine, with the latest optics, they're just mind-blowing images. So the first recent Juno news that caught my attention was what's going on underneath the iconic upper cloud layer. I mean, right, you think of Jupiter, the big red spot, of course. That's one of the first things you think of, which is getting smaller. Did you guys know that? I think we mentioned it on the show a while ago. It's shrinking since the late 1800s. It used to be so big that you could fit three Earths next to each other inside of that spot. Now it's like less, about an Earth, a little bit more than an Earth can fit inside of that spot. And it's so how sad would that be if it just disappeared? But if it does disappear, we got lots of other awesome stuff to look at and talk about. So we're trying to find out, we've been trying to find out for the longest time what's beneath what you can see pretty much with the unaided eye. Or some just optical instruments, the amazing bands and cloud structures. What's underneath that? How deep does that stuff go? We have not known anything about that for forever. It's been a mystery. So we haven't known about it. Wait, okay. So this has been a mystery since forever. So to get a peek, scientists actually used gravity. Specifically, what they did was they took the Doppler shift of radio signals that are coming off of Juno itself. So imagine Juno's, whipping around Jupiter and whatever's directly below Juno, the mass of Jupiter changes. Sometimes it's a little bit more mass. Sometimes it's a little bit less mass. Like if you're like a satellite in orbit around the Earth, if it's flying over, a huge, a big mountain, then you're going to actually, if you have sensitive enough equipment, you're going to detect that there's a huge mass underneath the ship. It's going to change its trajectory in just a tiny bit. In this case, it could change the Doppler shift of the radio signals that are coming from the whatever craft you have in orbit. And that's exactly what they did. So they have this gravity map of Jupiter, and it showed this weird north-south asymmetry underneath the top clouds, which was not expected. Because imagine, you've got this huge mass spinning at a great speed. You would think that it would be somewhat of an oblate spheroid shape, just like the Earth is, where it's flattened at the poles, and a little, kind of expansive out by the equator. But that's not what they saw. The best explanation for what they saw is that there had to be some sort of atmospheric flows underneath the top observable clouds. So based on that, they could extrapolate that these structures, these bands and zones and jet streams that you see, those colorful clouds that you see on top, they could be as deep as 3,000 kilometers. 3,000 kilometers. Deep. That's deeper than they thought it could be. So then from there, once you know how deep it probably is, then you could calculate, okay, how big is this weather that's orbited, that's essentially, flying around Jupiter at these amazing speeds. And they figured that this atmospheric weather around Jupiter is 1% of Jupiter's mass. So 1%, okay, that doesn't sound like a lot necessarily, but that is three Earth masses. So just as a raw number, that's a huge amount of mass. And if you compare it to Earth, I mean, Earth has a tiny atmosphere that's only 1/1,000,000th of the mass of the Earth. So the ratio of Earth's atmosphere to Earth's mass is tiny compared to what we're talking about in Jupiter, 1%. And then now we can imagine that you've got this atmosphere, this weather happening on the outside of Jupiter that goes down 3,000 kilometers at least. So at the bottom of that, once you travel to the bottom of that, then the rest of the planet behaves essentially like a solid. And so it's really, I mean, it's not, you know, it's not a solid as you know it. It's more, it's kind of a liquid-like mixture of hydrogen and helium, but it rotates like a regular solid. And so now that we have this most basic of pictures of what Jupiter's made of, you've got this huge core type area that's rotating as a solid, and then you've got like 3,000 kilometers of basically weather atmosphere. Then we could also extrapolate to other gas giants like Saturn, like Neptune, like other gas giants elsewhere in the solar system. And you can kind of, it could help us figure out what's going on with them if they have a kind of a similar setup. So that's it about, you know, the interior of Jupiter. The other thing that really caught my attention were the cyclones. Have you guys heard about those? These are visible now, basically. I mean, I think they had hints of them. They knew about these cyclones that are at the poles of Jupiter, North and South Pole. But Juno was the first craft the first probe that had this highly elliptical orbit. And because of that, it's had an unprecedented view of the North and Southern poles. And using its GIRAM, the Jovian Infrared Auroral Mapper, using that device, they've been able to get amazing images of what's going on at the poles like they've never seen before. So imagine huge cyclonic storms right next to each other with winds like Category 5 hurricane winds over 350 kilometers per hour, amazingly fast winds. To me, they look like these swirly cinnamon buns that are 7,000 kilometers wide. I mean, they did.
That sounds delicious.
But they are huge. It would take you forever to eat through a 7,000 kilometer cinnamon bun. But imagine you've got like, this is pretty much true for the South and Northern poles. So you put this big cinnamon bun in the middle, and then you've got five or eight around other cyclones around it, depending if you're on the Northern or Southern pole, respectively. So, I mean, that's an amazing structure. One cyclone surrounded by five or eight other ones. And they seem to be, you know, we don't know how long they've been there because we only recently started observing them, but they seem to be fairly permanent. They could have been there for decades or centuries. We're not sure, but they're gorgeous. You have to see them in the infrared, which is why that GIRAM instrument was so critical in really getting a look at their structure. But it's gorgeous, and there's nothing like them in the entire solar system. Gorgeous. So check them out. So I'll end with a really good quote by Scott Bolton, who's a Juno's principal investigator from the Southwest Research Institute in San Antonio. He said that these astonishing science results are yet another example of Jupiter's curveballs and a testimony to the value of exploring the unknown from a new perspective with next generation instruments. Juno's unique orbit and revolutionary high precision radio science and infrared technologies enabled these paradigm shifting discoveries. And I really like that quote because it shows you, like, yeah, we've had orbiters and probes around Jupiter before, many probes, have many pictures, many scientific surveys of Jupiter. But it just goes to show that now that we've got, you know, next gen or third or fourth removed generation instrumentality to send there, we could actually learn so much more by even just looking at the same things that were looked at 20 or 30 years ago. Our instrumentalities are so superior now that we're going to, you know, continue to learn more and more and be able to look at things that maybe we've never even looked at before. So I really like that quote to show you, yeah, we're not just repeating science. We're improving on what we've learned, and we're learning amazing things about Jupiter.
Gosh, how far have we just come since the Voyagers?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, and just those pictures, those images.
Those are revolutionary.
Oh my gosh. But we're you know, two generations beyond that now. And just incredible what we've learned about the planet. And so much more to learn.
Scratch the surface.
Scratched the surface.
Right. In 30 years, we'll be, you know, hopefully sending probes, you know, deeper down than they've ever been. I think they've been down 100 miles, which is kind of deep, but not deep at all when you're talking about Jupiter. So who knows how deep we'll eventually be able to get and really see what's going on down there. But yeah, beautiful stuff. Check it out online. The pictures are worth it.
All right. Thanks, Bob. Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Who's that noisy then?
Who's that noisy, governor? All right. Last week I played this noisy. What is it?
It's that cute bird from Last Jedi.
Oh, God.
I don't know what it is, but you turned it on, it sounds like.
Right?
It's a zipper. It's a zippity.
No, it's not a zipper. Marcus Noble sent in a guess. He said, this is a zip tie being pulled rapidly. That's not correct. James Joyce sent in a guess. I think this week's noisy is someone running their fingernail down a zip tie. That is also not correct. Has nothing to do with the zip tie, though I kind of get what you're saying. Mickey T said, I've been a listener for 18 months. This is the first time I thought I recognized the sound of Who's That Noisy. Is it wood duck mail calling? And then he goes on to say, I'm Japanese, but I studied at university in Missouri. I took an ornithology class and had to learn many bird calls. I think I got a C in that class. So I'm not 100% positive, but I thought I'd write in. This is the reason why I'm reading his email, though. I really enjoy the show. I wish Skeptics Movement was bigger, if it even exists in Japan. In addition to our traditional nonsense of Chinese medicine, etc., now we have anti-vaxxers, homeopathy believers, and anti-GMO people translating only the studies that suit them to promote their views. Many Japanese people, don't read English, so they don't fact-check and believe those are the cool Western views. Keep up the great work. Mickey, thanks for that. That is sad, but you know, you're a skeptic there, and you might be that person that could swing things to a more critical thinking side. So think about it, Mickey. I do have a notable guess. I'll read the winner first. The first person to guess correctly was Luke Rigoni, and Luke said, my guess for this week's noisy is that it's those egg-shaped magnets that make a buzzing sound when you throw them up in the air together. That's correct.
Oh.
So Elijah Dunn wrote a very wonderful description of what this is. So Elijah is my notable noisy of the answer of the week. And he said, this week's Who's That Noisy is the sound a pair of quote-unquote snake eggs or sizzlers or buzzers. There's lots of toys. Magnetic toys make. These ellipsoid magnets are coated in a hard epoxy to simultaneously protect the magnets and increase the elasticity of their collision. When tossed in the air or allowed to collide on a table, the small difference in the angle of approach as they come together makes the contact area shift back and forth across the center of mass. The movement emanates sound waves, and the combined sound and friction energy loss increases the oscillation frequency, leading to a rise in pitch. You can also make a less energetic sound by squeezing the pair of magnets at one end and releasing, which I suspect is the source of the Who's That Noisy, since it was short. Now I'm off to read all about the natural frequency of two magnets oscillating systems after I listen to the rest of the show, Elijah. So, yeah, thank you for that wonderful explanation, Elijah. So these are a lot of toys that people sent in. They recognize. A lot of people guessed correctly this week. They're called snake eggs or sizzlers, rattlesnake eggs, singing magnets, buzzers, buzzing stunt magnets, blah, blah, blah. But they're basically two elongated football kind of shaped magnets, and the listener that sent them in, Roger Fort, last week, took a video of him throwing them down onto the carpet. They're attracted to each other, and then they do that vibration attraction to each other till they rest. Very interesting sound. I knew that a lot of people were going to know it, but for those who didn't, it was a cool new sound to hear. So this week...
Yeah,
I liked it.
It was neat.
This week, I have a new noisy sent in by a listener named M.E. Lem, and here it is. There you have it.
That's a gong from David gong Carradine's show? Kung Fu show David Carradine's Kung Fu show from the 70s.
Oh, Kung Fu, right.
Oh, Bob, Shaolin Temple. God. Oh, you're right.
Yeah, I totally had that same vibe, Bob. Something like Tibetan or...
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, that's fun.
Wasn't it one of those Jamaican drums?
A steel drum? No, I don't think so.
No? No one knows, Evan. Not yet, at least. If you think you know the answer or you heard something really cool this week, and please don't stop sending me in your noisies. I need them. I like to collect them. You can email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
All right. Thanks, Jay.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real, one fake. And I challenge my panelist skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake-a-rooney. You guys ready for three news items this week?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
All right, here we go. Mm. Item number one, a new analysis finds that the heads of arachnids are evolved from legs. Item number two, scientists have discovered a new organ in the body, a previously unrecognized system of fluid-filled compartments in skin and connective tissue. And item number three, researchers have discovered a potential mechanism to disable a fungus that currently destroys 30% of the world's rice crop each year. Evan, go first.
The heads of arachnids are evolved from legs. Okay. I have to kind of wrap my brain around that a little bit. It seems like a entirely backwards way of going about evolution there. But maybe not. Simpler to more complex could be the key here, and certainly a leg is simpler and a head is more complex. Next one, the scientists have discovered a new organ in the body, previously unrecognized system of fluid-filled compartments in the skin and connective tissue. Okay, so beyond the skin and connective tissue, I guess it was once deemed to be part of it, but it now has reached the definition of its own organ, and if I knew what that technical definition was, that would really help me out here. But I do not. And then the last one.
I could tell you.
Ooh.
But I won't.
And then the last one about researchers discovering a potential mechanism to disable a fungus that currently destroys 30% of the world's rice crop. Wow. Boy, I really hope this one is true. That's major. It sounds like they're not 100% sure, but they're on to something. So there's a lot of latitude here. And of course, it's a good news story. So I like that one. Therefore, I guess I will go with I just don't really see it in this particular case with arachnids. I mean, I think of like the head's more of like the center of the arachnid, and then things sort of spring out from that and not the other way around. That's all I've got. So I'll say the arachnids one is the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Heads of arachnids are evolved from legs. Yeah, I'm not buying that. That seems like a very unlikely evolution. But let's cover the other ones while I'm here. The new organ, yeah, that I think that's plausible. When you know, if it were any other type of organ, I'd be like, I don't know about that. But this seems like something that could just kind of slip notice. And then you know, once you really looked at it, like, oh man, yeah, this is kind of fits the classic definition of what an organ is. I'd love to know what the fluid is. You know, what's it really doing besides just like maybe using as shock absorbers. So yeah, the fungus. I hope that's true. I really hope that's true. The fact that you use the word potential mechanism makes this even more believable, which maybe I shouldn't have told you that.
I mentioned it already.
But I don't think you said that the word potential – you said it was important. I said it made it more believable. So now we may be seeing the word potential in more of Steve's fake ones in the future.
Mm.
So yeah, so that one seems – yeah, potentially. So that one seems pretty likely, is much more likely as well. So yeah, the arachnid one, I'm not kind of buying that from a head from a leg.
And Jay.
Right, so so this weird one about the heads of arachnids are evolved from legs. Yes, very much like nanotechnology, the answer is always yes when it comes to insects with me. Sure, their heads grew from legs, whatever. Okay. Next one. The scientists discovered a new organ in the body, a previously unrecognized system of fluid-filled sacs, mostly filled of ugly water, in skin and connective tissue. Thank you,
wait,
Bob.
Now, I didn't, ugly water.
Hey, wait, what's that, Star Trek? So, this one seems relatively cromulent. It's not like you have another like liver-type organ or a kidney. It's more of like a system, right? I think the key word here is the system. It's fluid-filled compartments. I think that one is science. And the last one here, researchers have discovered a potential mechanism to disable a fungus. Jesus, that currently destroys 30% of the world's rice crops each year. Again, like I agree with everyone. I wish this one were science, but I don't think this one is the science. I'm going to question whether or not which information in here is the correct versus the incorrect. 30% of the world's rice crop each year. Do we lose 30% of our rice crop each year globally due to fungus? Did you guys know why they grow rice in water?
Because that's where it grows.
To prevent
there are other options.
predation and stuff, and to save it from bugs and all sorts of crazy stuff, except fungus, apparently.
I'll tell you what. I pick that one as the fiction, and I will reveal the answer after Steve does his reveal. Yes.
Oh. Right.
Okay.
Kind of a quiz within a quiz that we're doing.
So you guys all agree on number two. Scientists have discovered a new organ in the body, a previously unrecognized system of fluid-filled compartments in skin and connective tissue. You all think that one is science, and that one is science.
Yeah.
Okay.
Baby.
So the definition of organ is...
This one got out in the news late in the day today, but I kept it anyway just to be nice to you guys.
Ah, thanks.
In fact, and did you notice that somebody emailed this to us like 2 hours ago?
Ooh.
Maybe.
Let's see. So this is a little gift for me. But because I wanted to talk about it. So how do you think, if you didn't read deep into the article, how do you think we missed it for so many years? I mean, it's 2018 and we missed a freaking organ in the body, even though it's a distributed organ. You know, it's interstitium. It's not only in the skin, it's in the connective tissue. It's, you know, in all of the connective.
Because it's a system, because it's a collection of different parts of the body. It's not just one spot.
Incorrect.
Well, when you think organ, you're not thinking this type of stuff, you know?
Right, the skin's an organ.
That's
right. Yeah, but even that's a famous kind of like trick question. Right. What's the biggest organ? Skin.
Let me clarify. It's not that they didn't realize that it was an organ. They completely missed the existence of these fluid-filled cavities.
Missed it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe. Wow. What's the answer? They did?
Yeah.
They missed it?
Yeah.
They didn't know it existed?
That's correct.
That's remarkable.
Whoa.
That puts a different paint job on it, huh?
Sure does.
So here's how. Because when you fix tissue to look at under a slide, it takes all the fluid out.
An artifact of the fixation technique.
Totally,
nice.
Yeah, an artifact. And so then the connective tissue is collapsing, like pancaking down into a dense layer, and we thought that's what it was. But then in living tissue, it's actually expanded into this spongy, fluid-filled interstitium.
That's awesome.
Yeah, this is lymph. This is the lymphatic fluid that gets drained out of tissue and goes through the lymphatic system. And it's just this really vast network. It also makes organs very flexible, right? So you think that, like as Jay learned to his horror recently, organs are pulsating and moving and, you know, and they can't rip or be rigid or tear. You know, you need something that's spongy and flexible. And this gives that. When you think about it, right? So it makes it
That's
more resilient.
Awesome.
Yeah. But it was just a total artifact, you know, of how we were fixing tissue.
Yeah, yeah. So what would happen if you could you ever do an organ transplant of this?
No, I don't.
Yeah, way too complex. You need nanotech to do that.
You go too far, sir.
So it's lymphatic fluids?
Yeah.
What does it do? I mean, besides what you said, you know, cushioning and protecting organs.
It's
but,
a
I
massive
mean,
part of the immune system.
All right. Well, damn. I mean, how did we miss that? I mean, so a huge chunk of the immune system has now like appeared, right? I mean, how does that change theories and things? It's like, come on.
Well, yeah, it may really help. It may give us insights that we didn't have before, even about how some diseases work, you know?
Wow.
Wow. That's awesome.
Huh.
Oh, still new stuff, new fundamental things to learn.
New organs. What the hell? All right. Unconventional organ, but still a cool one.
All right. Let's go to number one. A new analysis finds that the heads of arachnids are evolved from legs. Bob and Evan, you think this one is the fiction. Jay, you think this one is science. And this one is... the fiction.
Yeah, baby.
Oh, sorry, Jay.
Damn.
You subverted this from another.
I did.
Another. Yes, you did. The,
completely
scorpion,
subverted.
I didn't
scorpion
read any
tail.
Of these,
the scorpion tail one?
No. Nope.
No.
The
oh my God.
Chicken in the
a
egg
completely
one?
Unrelated article. Because I read an article where they showed an ancient spider that had a tail and that showed that they really are related to scorpions.
No.
And that was cool.
This article, co-option of an appendage patterning gene cassette in the head segmentation of arachnids. So essentially...
Wait, say that again.
Co-option of an appendage patterning gene cassette in the head segmentation of arachnids.
So kind of like is it a Hox gene?
Yes. What the study found was that a regulatory gene for legs in insects, in arthropods was lost in arachnids. The regulatory gene for the head segment was lost in arachnids, and instead they use a modified version of their leg regulatory gene. So this is all about the genes, but that doesn't mean that their legs evolved into a head.
Yeah, definitely not.
But the write-arounds and the press release were kind of ambiguous, and I had to read it. I had to go to the original article to confirm my suspicion.
There you go.
Yeah, that'll do it.
It's like, they never explicitly said that. No, this doesn't mean the legs evolved into the head. What it means is that they repurposed a gene, a regulatory gene from the legs to the head to replace one that was lost, or that happened first and then the head one became redundant and was lost.
Yeah. Don't you hate that? So there's this critical link, critical nugget that you're looking for to answer, because when you want to describe something, you know, that you wanted, that's something that you feel is important to explain. And that happened to me on this week's episode with the Jupiter story, because I'm trying to figure out, all right, you have this gravity data of Jupiter, but why does that make you conclude, therefore, that the storms are so deep? And one article had it, like only the deep storms could explain the asymmetry of the north-south gravity map. So it's like one silly little article had it. Nobody else explained that properly. Right. And I finally found it. It's like, now I know.
But this is a bad week for press releases. I read a number of press release fails this week.
Yikes.
This was one of them where I thought they didn't really like explain exactly what was happening. Only because of my biology background that I suspect that this was the case, and then I had to confirm it with the real article. But let me go to number three.
You tried to trick us, though. You tried to trick us because you were hoping that we had seen the
always.
Title, and then we might. But I'm the specific type, type of trick where you read the title and you get screwed. So luckily, we didn't see that title.
There's a couple of ones that I did not use. I'm going to tell you about that were amazing, but All right, but let's go to number three. Researchers have discovered a potential mechanism to disable a fungus that currently destroys 30% of the world's rice crop each year. That is science. The fungus is rice blast. That's the disease. And it's a fucking
rice blast.
It's a fungus that destroys up to 30% of the world's rice crop each year.
Awful.
That's terrible.
And what they found was a single protein. They found a chemical that inhibits the gene for a single protein. And when you do that, the fungus doesn't spread within the rice plant. It stays within the leaf.
Interesting.
And therefore, it doesn't spread and it doesn't get spread to other plants.
That's awesome.
Gosh, much research went into figuring that out? I bet of research.
This write-up was good, but that's because I went to the press release from the University of Exeter where the study comes from, and their press office did a good job because they really explain what's going on here in good detail. And also, you know, they make the point that now this is not an approved treatment, right? This is not ready for the field. This is just a laboratory test that identified the mechanism. So now we have to go through the years of research to actually develop a product from this then that could be deployed in the field. But I didn't realize until I read this that we lost 30% of our rice crop, the world's rice crop every year. So that's a huge potential. We could increase rice yields
by
30%.
Oh my gosh. How many people
just
can
by
feed?
Wiping out this one pest?
Right. Yep. I mean, this isn't Snickers production. This is worldwide rice crop. I mean, that's
think about right,
how
the
many
staple food
gigatons.
For how many people?
Yeah, think about how many lives would be saved when they do this.
So they say that the rice blast destroys enough rice each year to feed 60 million people.
Gee whiz.
Wow. That's a lot.
Wow.
That's more than I thought.
Incredible. Yeah.
60.
So, all right. Well, I failed again. I don't even remember the last time I won science or fiction for Christmas.
Stick with it, Jay. You don't give up. All right. Let me tell you the massive one massive fail. So let me know what you guys what your reaction to this news item is. The press release says that astronomers have found an exoplanet, and that's unusual in a specific way. It is the size of It's an Earth. It's slightly bigger than the Earth, but it has a mantle to core ratio similar to Mercury, and that it was discovered around a star 360 million light years away.
Well, how the hell did they know the mantle to core ratio on an exoplanet that far away? What technique did they use to determine that?
Yeah, that's the
mantle
first
to core ratio? That's ridiculous. Well,
you need the radius of the planet, and you need its density. You need its mass. So right. So then you infer the density from the mass and the
fine. Density is one thing, but mantle to core ratio. How do you infer that?
Well, because that affects the density of the planet. So it's an inner terrestrial world with the density of Mercury. So it probably has a ratio similar to Mercury. But yeah, but you're kind of hitting on the thing that immediately struck me. It's like, wait a minute.
This is 360 million light years away. Wait a second. That's well outside the Milky Way.
Are they
using gravitational lens?
Didn't we only recently confirm exoplanets outside our galaxy?
Yeah. So that's the thing. My initial reaction was, 360 million light years away. No effing way. Sorry. And the only mechanism would be micro lensing. And that micro lensing, you can only infer that the existence of the planet
there.
You cannot tell its mass or its radius. You need a transit method for that.
That's the biggest. That's the biggest one. Yep.
And there's no
too
way.
Far. You can't see it.
No way that we've spotted anything with the transit method 360 million light years away. So I had to dig back to the original paper.
Yeah.
And guess how far away the Star Wars.
36 light years away.
It was 360 light years.
Yeah.
Away.
Okay. Oops.
But they said 360 million throughout the entire press release.
Wow, that's just sloppy.
A press release.
That's terrible.
Yes. Not even very a report sloppy. About it. Ooh, very, very sloppy. Oops. Did you write them and say
factor of a million?
How many people are writing them saying a million? I think you need to correct this and reissue.
That's sloppy. I mean, we all make mistakes. Sloppy. Obviously we make mistakes on the show, but that is like the kind of thing that if anybody who knew what they were talking about wouldn't make that kind of mistake. That's a brain fart.
Six orders of magnitude.
Yeah. Not the kind of thing, like we misspeak, but that's different than in you're writing something and you repeat it multiple times and no one picks up the fact that you're off by a factor of a million.
I mean, I get that people have a hard time contemplating the vastness of the universe, but still.
I know, but if you have a reasonable familiarity with astronomy, you should know orders of magnitude.
Absolutely.
Yep. You should know that our galaxy is about 100,000 light years. The Andromeda is about 2 million light years away, et cetera. Things like that,
Yeah, true. But I still wouldn't expect a lot of people, Steve, to recognize that you're not going to determine that kind of detail in a planet that far away. I mean, I don't know. That's a little more subtle. That's more subtle.
On the southern continent of the planet, we're seeing interesting structures.
Yeah, right.
This is way out of proportion. The other one was, all right, so there's a study. This is what they did. They're trying to transfer electricity from one plate to another plate 12 inches apart. And they figured out that they can do that if they increase the frequency of the alternating current. Then they were able to transfer very, very quickly, have electrical current jump from one plate to the other one across air, right? Whereas at normal frequencies, it really not much would get across. That's the study.
That doesn't sound right. Frequency.
This is legit. That's legit. And
it's pretty neat.
What I just told you is completely legit.
But how did they report it? Right.
Yeah. How it was reported was the dubious part. So the headline and the write-up was all about how scientists have developed a technique to recharge cars as they drive along the road.
Now, come on. Really? That's where they went with that?
Well, that's propaganda. I mean, that is like just wrong.
Now, that's a potential application of this.
Well, sure.
But that's so many steps removed. That would be fine to mention at the end of the article. Oh, here are some possible applications for this.
Yeah, that's something I would say at the end, not the,
not the headline. This was like the lead was that they developed a technique for recharging electric vehicles as they drive along the road. No.
Crazy people.
That's flipping, and we see that a lot in scientific press releases. They bury the actual result of the study and then they lead with the speculation about where it might go.
That's a problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So you want to hear my info about rice?
Yeah. Tell us.
So you guys are mostly correct. I mean, the bottom line is rice can tolerate being in water.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And when they grow rice in water like that, it does two things. It keeps pests away and it controls weeds.
Does it?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, we kind of nailed it.
But not fungus. Fungus likes moisture.
Yeah, that's right. Right. So I'm sure that's why I thought of that, Steve. But because of them growing it in water, it's supposed to create higher yields. And I thought that was interesting, Steve, that fungus is probably, you know, the water might be helping it grow, and then it could also be helping it spread because it essentially connects all those plants.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Hey, a couple of quick announcements, guys, real quick. Nexus this year, July 12th to the 15th. Me and Brian Weck today finalized our workshops, which happen on Thursday. That's the 12th. We have some really cool things that we're pulling this year, pulling because, you know, we always start with these fantastic ideas. And when we pick a couple of them, we're like, I hope people like it. You know, last year we had a really great one, and we have a couple of really, really good ones this year that we hope that you guys would come check out. We have a final speaker list as well. And right now you could register for the pre-sale premium pass. And in less than a week, we will have our standard registration opened up for the conference. So we're looking forward to it this year. We hope that you guys can make it. And also, I just wanted to say a quick thank you to our patrons on Patreon. We've been having a ton of fun chatting on the Discord server. We have our first private stream that's going to be happening soon. We're going to schedule that very soon. We're trying to pick a time where people globally can see it. You know, a nice time that people will be awake either – not crazy early or crazy late, but we're trying to make it happen. So if you haven't checked out our Patreon yet, you can go to patreon.com/skeptics guide.
Evan, you got a quote for us?
I do. We should be careful when interpreting the behavior of others. What might appear to be laziness, dishonesty, or stupidity might be better explained by situational factors of which we are ignorant. The wise words of Robert Todd Carroll, American writer, academic, and a fine skeptic he was.
Yeah. That is the fundamental attribution error that he's talking about there.
Mm-hmm.
Something that you could read about in our upcoming book.
Yes.
Which will be released October 2nd.
That's right. Yes, indeed.
And our final cover to be revealed very soon.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
As soon as the book comes out, I'll take the first opportunity to say, and for further details, consult my published works. That's right. You know what that's from?
No,
sounds familiar.
Oh, damn.
Come on. Lose one geek point. Harry Potter.
No. Oh God. Yes. Oh,
of course.
Right. Oh, damn
of
it.
Course.
Damn it.
For the details, consult my published book.
That was a great character.
Without the smile and the wink, it was hard to tell. Okay.
He was great in that role. He was fun.
All right, guys.
Right then. Good night, Governor.
Thank you all for joining me this week.
Righto then.
Certainly.
Cheerio.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.